welcome to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. My name is Michelle Boyce, and this is a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. Today's topic, community engagement in politics. And we have two of the probably the leading experts here in London, Ontario on the topic. Later in the show, we have Glenn Pearson, who, after losing the last federal election, has dedicated his life to this very topic. And so he's on later in the show. But first off, we have a newcomer to provincial politics, Peggy Sadler. And she's thrown her hat into the ring after a four-time trustee election, been in the education system and with the NDP since the beginning of time, and and then some. You know, she's part of the Andrea Horvath team, and she is the nominated candidate for the NDP in London West in the not yet called, we're waiting, any day now, Catherine Wynne. We appreciate the notice, so you know, anytime you want to, you know, just throw that out there and set a date, we're good with that. And you know, so Peggy has thrown her hat into the London West race after Chris Bentley, who was plagued with scandal after scandal, resigned his seat back in January, wasn't it, Peggy?
February,
yes. So Peggy, welcome.
Thanks a lot for having me, Michelle.
And so, Peggy, you threw your hat into the provincial politics ring, and politics to you is nothing new. Why did you decide now is the time to jump from the school board to a more provincial level?
Well, I was first elected to the school board in 2000 when my kids were just beginning school, and have really enjoyed my time serving at the board. I was chair for two terms at the board and found it very rewarding. In the last 5 or so years, I've gotten much more involved at the provincial level, at the Ontario Public School Boards Association, and of course, Catherine Fife, who was elected last summer in a by-election in Kitchener-Waterloo, had been president of the Ontario Public School Boards Association, and really brought a progressive voice to the NDP caucus. Very proud of what she and the other members of the caucus have been able to accomplish in Catherine's short time at the legislature. But really, for me, the Bill 115 and the loss of democratic rights for labor unions and for school boards in terms of our role in collective bargaining at the local level, that was very much a tipping point for me because of the upheaval that it created in the public education system, the willingness of the Liberal government to jeopardize all the gains that had been made in public education over the last 10 years. It was a real concern for me, and I really strongly believe that that the Liberals have outworn their mandate. We've seen a lot of really poor decision making in the last little while, in particular, and I believe that I would be a strong voice for the people of London West.
Well, as you know, I'm a firm believer in that as well. You know, I worked on your nomination campaign with you, and I was proud to do that with you. You know, and you and I have worked together for a few years, you know, through the school board. We sat on the Thames Valley Parent Involvement Committee, and, you know, so you and I are a little bit comfortable with each other. So, you know, put that out there to the listener. So, you know, we're not strangers to each other. And, you know, I'm not a stranger to the NDP. I worked Cathy Cornish's campaign in the last election. So, you know, it's my feeling that our government and we need a more, you know, a more socially involved system. And, you know, later on, Glenn talks a lot about, you know, voter suppression and that kind of thing. But with you, I want to talk about the positives. And, you know, the stats are absolutely absurd with voter turnout. Right? Youth are coming out to the polls at a level of 35%. And, you know, we've got 29% of the population saying that they just don't care about politics anymore. And, you know, so we've got all of this disassociated voters out there. And you know, we want to engage them in the process. And you know, we need to start, I don't know, what's the solution? Do we get people to care? How do, you know, you have gotten involved in politics and thrown your hat into this ring for some really great reasons. You know, how do we get everybody else involved too?
I've always believed, my whole life as a New Democrat, I joined the party when I was in university, and I've always believed that politics is a way to make positive, meaningful changes in people's lives, and that's what has motivated me at the school board, and it will continue to motivate me as a member of provincial parliament. But one of the things that I learned from the school board way back in 2000, I had a group of LGBT2 students who were came to the school board to protest on the front lawn of the school board office to say that schools were, they felt unsafe in our schools, that schools were not working, our safe schools policies were not working for LGBT students. And as a trustee, I had the opportunity to make change, and I pledged to those students that I would do whatever I could at the trustee level to take their concerns forward. This was before the Supreme Court had legalized same-sex marriage. It was way before the provincial government passed legislation on gay-straight alliances. But what we did is we created an action plan to address the needs of LGBT students. We involved students directly in that process. We had the student trustee was a member of our ad hoc committee that was looking at the issue. And we had an LGBT student representative also on the committee. We met with PFLAG to hear the concerns of parents of LGBT students and about their experiences in the school system. And we really got students engaged because they saw that their concerns were being listened to, that we were hearing more about the their lived experiences in our system, and that we were committed to taking action. And I think that that's critical for engagement in the political process. People have to feel that they are being listened to, and that concrete action will be taken as a result of their participation. And we've seen, you know, just look at what's happening recently with all of the scandals at the municipal level, with mayors and corruption, and what we've seen at the federal level with senators and expense claims, you know, false expense claim forms, and what we've seen at the provincial level with public dollars being spent for cynical political reasons, like the relocation of the gas plants, all the public money that was wasted on Orange and eHealth. These are dollars that could be spent much more wisely and effectively on programs and services that people need. So I think there is a lot of all of this stuff that's happening at all these different levels of government is really contributing to greater political disengagement at the same time that we know that when you engage communities in identifying issues, in coming up with solutions, that you have much better quality outcomes and a much more responsive programs and services. So there's this real tension going on that has to be addressed if we want to really be able to respond to the real needs of people and families in our communities.
And we see this around the world, and these tensions are happening in pretty much every single country. And, you know, people are starting to, I think they're starting to wake up, and they're starting to realize that they need to engage in these processes. And my hope is that Canada will engage in the process before we have to rip our streets apart.
Yeah, and I think that we have a generational opportunity right now in London, in Ontario, and in Canada, likely around the world. But when you look at levels of youth unemployment, this is some youth want to be able to participate meaningfully in the labor market. They want to be able to contribute their skills and build a more just, progressive society. And the levels of youth unemployment are more than double that of adult unemployment. And in London, we already already have the dubious distinction of being the community with the highest rate of unemployment in the country. So this is an issue that is really grabbing the attention of youth. Youth want to have they want to participate in the economy. And at the same time, we also see that youth really care about the issues like the environment. We saw the Occupy movement and the level of youth engagement in those kinds of issues. And so I think this is a moment where if we can harness that kind of concern that youth have demonstrated about global warming, about, you know, creating livable, walkable communities that enable everyone to participate and contribute in meaningful ways, that we could really, you know, we could really have a much more progressive vision and a much more, you know, engaged society and just better living, a better life for everyone.
Well, there goes Glenn Pearson's comments in the next segment about, you know, politicians avoiding the issues. You seem to, you know, be tackling every single one of them right there. So you're not only just an educator, and your expertise isn't just in education. You're also a labor researcher, and your passion is in that. Can you talk a bit about, you know, your experiences around the labor market? And you mentioned the economy and these kind of things, you know. What do you bring to the table about that kind of part of the job?
I've been working for about 3 years now on a multi-year project that's looking at work-integrated learning programs. These are programs like co-ops, internships, field placements. They go by any number of different names depending on the institutions. But the project involved 14 post-secondary institutions. We had 8 universities and 6 colleges across the province who participated. We did a survey of over 10,000 Ontario students who were graduating from post-secondary education to talk about their experiences in work-integrated learning programs. Now, obviously, not all the students that participated in our survey had participated in work-integrated learning, and we asked those who hadn't if they wished they had had that opportunity. And what we found is whether at college or at university, students really would like to have the chance to participate in programs that let them apply what they are learning in their studies, in their theoretical academic programs, with actual real-world experiences. This could be in the nonprofit sector. It could be working toward, a global development issue through service learning. It could be a community-based learning program with a local not-for-profit organization, or it could be in a business, a for-profit business where youth have the opportunity to be employed as co-op students. And there is really high levels of interest in participating in those kinds of programs. So about half of the university students who we talked to who hadn't participated in one of those programs wish they had, because they really, you know, youth are caught in this kind of vicious circle of you can't get a job without experience, and you can't get experience unless you have a job. So ensuring that there are these kinds of programs as part of a post-secondary course of study would really enable these students to have that leg up when they complete their program and get into the labor market. But at the same time, I do want to make it clear that the study is not positioning colleges and universities as mere, you know, conveyors of employees into the labor market. There needs to be, and the reason it's called work integrated learning is because it has to integrate what students are learning at school with what's happening in the workplace, and vice versa. So these programs have to really engage students in thinking critically about the nature of the workplace in terms of the way workplaces are structured, in terms of the hierarchical relationships within workplaces, and so they should be really sort sort of building up students' critical thinking skills at the same time that they're providing them with actual work experiences.
When we're talking at the school level, and you know, that's what we're talking about, and we're talking, I mean, your campaign is full of youth, and there's a lot of youth engagement. You had your very first canvas that you did was a youth canvas, which is awesome, you know, engaging those youth voices in the campaign and the process. So it's really nice to see the youth that you've built in this. How do we build that into more youth getting involved in policy and more youth getting engaged in the political process? And you know, jobs are amazing, and we have a huge problem here with jobs in London, but we have a problem also with bad decisions being made in politics, and youth are disenfranchised. And when I talk to my son and my daughter about politics, they tune out. And they have a very politically engaged mom.
Yeah.
You know, and my kids, they're up on it and they understand it. And, you know, I've met your kids too, and you know, they've got a very politically engaged mom too. So, you know, trying to engage our own kids in the process is complicated.
It is. And one of the things I wanted to say earlier is that what's so important to keep in mind is that it can't be a one-size-fits-all model, that we need processes of engagement that respect the cultural, ethnic, racial, sexual, you know, all of the different kinds of diversity that exists within an increasingly diverse society. So we need to identify appropriate processes of engagement that will respect those differences between youth. And we also need to engage with youth in the media that they use, that is most direct for them. And I admit, you know, as somebody who's a digital immigrant or whatever they call, I admit that this is something that I am still learning, and I go to my son or daughter when I, you know, when I need some help on social media, all this, like, it's just evolving so rapidly, all of these new forms of social media. But this is something I'm really committed to. I want to have as part of my campaign the best social media experts who are fluent in this kind of social media forms of communication, because I think that this is critical. We can't be stuck in the old processes of political engagement when we are dealing with new generations of young people. And certainly the Obama campaign recognized this, harnessed it magnificently. And I think there's a lot to be learned from those kinds of experiences in other jurisdictions.
Well, the conservatives, you know, are spending a whole pile of money on people monitoring social media these days. So, you know, politicians have definitely taken the Arab Spring lessons to heart, that you can't ignore social media and politics. And you're right. I mean, the youth, I run a youth group and I engage youth on a daily basis, and most of my engagement with them are via text messaging and Facebook and messaging systems that are digital and online. Very rarely do youth engage me in a personal conversation on the phone.
I was just at a conference for the Ontario Public School Boards Association a couple of weeks ago, and there was a teacher from the Toronto District School Board. She was wearing a T-shirt that said, "I was born before the internet," and she said her students, she's an elementary school teacher, but her students couldn't conceive of a world without the internet. This kind of blew them away, that somebody could have been born before the internet, because for them, the internet is like air. It's like something that is essential to human beings, and they just couldn't imagine a world without it. But she was addressing the people who were at the conference and talking about her use of Twitter to engage students and their families and the effectiveness of Twitter. She uses it as a homework tool. Like, she really has integrated it. it into the classroom environment. And I think that this really is the way of the future. And, you know, education will have to get on that, you know, on that bandwagon as well. No, I don't want to call it a bandwagon because it's not a bandwagon. Education will need to be in front because right now the generation of people who are teaching are you know, they're lagging behind the students who are, we have babies who are learning on iPads, you know, before.
Yep.
Yeah. So we need to recognize the kind of students who are coming into our schools, and we have to be able, we have to have the technical tools on hand that will engage them in the way that they are used to be, that they are accustomed to being engaged before they come into our classrooms.
Yeah, books are becoming obsolete.
I'm a huge reader, and so I will never concede to the loss of literature. I think literature has a lot to, you know, literature inspires us and teaches us about the meaning of the human condition. But there are different ways to consume literature. It doesn't have to be, you know, in the traditional printed form. As somebody who comes from that generation, that's the way that I'm accustomed to literature, but that doesn't mean that that's the only way. So I'm quite confident that there will continue to be a role for literature in this new world that we're entering.
According to StatsCan, the most disenfranchised people with the electoral process are single parents, single moms, new immigrants, and youth. You know, these are the people that aren't voting.
And these are the people who have been least well served by our current political structures. These are the people who have seen their, you know, their needs, their priorities, their issues completely neglected in the decisions that are made by elected officials. And that's why we need, some of these people, Rob Ford in Toronto, Stephen Harper, and the Pamela Wallen, the decisions that are, well, what's happening at the political level, it's kind of no wonder that people are cynical about politics. They don't see public dollars being spent on the things that matter most to them and their families. And, you know, that's why I am so committed to being a member of the NDP, because I think of that the NDP has always put the needs of people who are typically disenfranchised, who are typically, you know, underrepresented in power structures. The needs of those people, youth, senior citizens, those people's needs have always been put ahead of the needs of big corporations and others who are already doing quite well in the global economy.
Well, they created the economy, and they created the rules, and they created the, you know, everything to their advantage.
And they also created the fallout, as we saw in the global financial meltdown. So they haven't done such a great job.
No, and I think we need to look at politics differently. And when we look at the Quebec political environment, where the student riots and the student unions and grassroots political engagement that happened in that country that toppled a government, you look at that kind of engagement in the process, and you look at Ontario right next door, that we don't have that kind of engagement in the system.
No, we don't. I think what we've seen lately in the K-12 sector, and as a trustee, I am, that is a sector that I'm quite familiar with, but there's this emergence of this new, this new kind of approach. They're calling it the student voice. And so there's a real focus on student voice in many of the school board initiatives. But I think that this is, you know, again, this is an opportunity to engage youth, to make them realize that they can, that their participation, that it's worth their while to participate if we can respond to the concerns that they raise through the process. So if you continue to develop programs and services and introduce policies, and you just pay lip service to involving young people, then you are going to continue to see that those levels of disengagement. But if we can start to make youth realize that their participation can lead to different outcomes, that it can change the course of the direction that the government or that politicians are heading, then I think that we'll really see some progress.
And I think that goes out to a nonpartisan approach that every single party and every single politician needs to take heed of. And you can't ignore your constituents continuously and expect to stay elected. And I think that's, the polls across the country are showing that. But there's the other polls. I mean, BC just had their election with the lowest voter turnout on record. They had 52% turnout in the provincial election in BC. And considering the engagement that's happened in BC with pipelines and international press and stories coming out of BC, I worry about, that even with all of these extremely big issues that are on the table in BC, they couldn't get anyone out to the polls.
Yeah, and I'm hearing it a little bit on the doorsteps as I'm canvassing in London West. There's always, you always encounter voters who say, I just don't vote. It doesn't, you know, I don't feel that it's going to make a difference, so why would I bother voting? And I always try to take the time with those people to talk about the fact that voting does make a difference, and talk about some of the things that I have done as a trustee, as an elected official. And I want to go back to something you said earlier, Michelle, about if you want to stay elected, you have to respond to the needs of your electors. For me, it's not about staying elected. For me, the reason I got elected as a trustee, the reason I want to be elected as an MPP is not to be elected. It's to put in place the programs and services that people need. And people whose priorities have not been addressed in effective ways in the past. And I know that I have to engage some of these people who've seen too many politicians who are elected, who only care about being elected, and who don't care about actually doing the things that matter to the constituents that they represent.
Well, thank you very much, Peggy. Time flies. We're having fun. Is there anything else you'd like to close with?
Just to say what a pleasure it's been to be on this show, and I really appreciate the opportunity to have this discussion. I think what this show is great, and hope to be back.
Wonderful. So we will be back after the break with Glenn Pearson and more about community engagement in politics.
We are all in this together.
Welcome back to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. My name is Michelle Boyce, and that was Peggy Sadler, who is the new up-and-coming politician in London West. And thank you very much, Peggy, for coming on the show. Next up, we have Glenn Pearson, who is an exiting politician from the scene. And unfortunately, Glenn was subjected to conservative tactics and robocalls at the last election and lost his seat due to some really, really conservative dirty tricks that cost him votes and disengaged the public in the process. And unfortunately, that's what happens when politicians use U.S. style campaigning processes, is that it disengages the people in the process. And you know, the left really works hard to re-engage the people in the process, and the right seems to disengage the population because, let's face it, you know, the more people don't vote, as we've seen, the more conservative type governments get elected. So it's very important, you know, if you're actually, you know, feeling that the government isn't doing anything for you, not voting is actually setting that up for you. And, you know, you've got to look at it differently. I mean, a long time ago, I've used the words myself. I just don't vote because there's nobody worth voting for. And an engagement in the process is the only way to have someone that's worth voting for. And that's my experience. And since I have engaged in the political system, since I've engaged in volunteering for political parties, since I've engaged in working with candidates, it's more given me a voice, but it's also allowed me to feel like I'm a part of the process. And you know, the stuff that's coming out of this country is going international. And, you know, voter fraud. Here is a very short clip from Iran, of all places, criticizing Canada.
Our top story this hour. A top court in Canada has confirmed that the election in 2011, which led to the victory of Stephen Harper's government, was fraudulent. The federal court has emphasized in a ruling that it has found, quote, in no uncertain terms that widespread election fraud took place during the vote. The ruling also states that there was an orchestrated effort to suppress votes during the election campaign by a person with access to the Conservative Party's database. Accordingly, the Council of Canadians, rather, has called on the Conservative Party to investigate the issue. It says anything less at this point would be a cover-up on behalf of the Conservatives.
And here's Glenn Pearson talking about community engagement in politics.
I'm Glenn Pearson. I'm a 62-year-old ex-MP, but I direct the food bank here in London. I'm father of seven children, and I'm, you know, I really enjoy community life. I'm glad I'm out of politics. I didn't enjoy it at all, but I think part of the reason for that was because of my discouragement for citizens. All I can say to them is, you know, make all these efforts worthwhile for everybody, including you and the work that you're doing there, that people just get out and start making a difference. And if you do, the politicians will listen. They have no other choice because you're the one that selects them. If they know you're not going to, they've lost a job. So get out and start voting. When I lost the election back in 2011, I had to figure out what I was going to do, and there were these job offers that were given, but I told my wife I just want to do community work, and because from what I could see on the democracy side is that as bad as I saw Parliament was, I saw that citizens just weren't caring. In fact, they were getting turned off more by the day, and I felt I wanted to spend my time trying to get citizens back, re-engaged into that process and what they would have to do to make the changes. So that's all I've done for 2 years besides directing the food bank. So it's kind of where my heart's at anyway.
So before we talk about engaging citizens, let's talk a little bit about, you know, why citizens aren't engaged. And I mean, that's the opposite, and that's voter suppression. So where are we? I mean, in the last federal election, I think we had 62% turnout. BC's provincial election just had a 52% turnout. We've got youth coming out at the polls at 35%.
Yeah, I mean, it's my sense that, you know, there are a number of factors that have lent to that. One is, you know, increasing kind of individualism in society where not as many people are as involved in institutions as they used to be. And I think that kind of institutional involvement always gave citizens a feeling like they belonged to something. And so there would be issues there that would have, let's say you were belong to a union, or you belong to a large company, or you belong to a Rotary Club, or you belong to a church, whatever it was, there would always be these issues that would be affecting the kind of life that you were trying to live. And I think that that kind of institutionalism kept people involved. Now people are much more independent. And that's true, especially of the younger demographic who I spent a fair bit of time with. They don't really belong to institutions. And so as a result, when they get turned off by politics and what they see, they're not part of something that's really trying to encourage them to get back and get engaged. So I think that's part of it. But definitely, I think the greatest part has been just how politics itself has behaved. that it's been the kind of thing where people look at and they just don't want to be part of, period. And they figure, what's the point of voting for A, B, or C when all they're going to do is what the party wants anyway? They're not going to listen to me. I think that's been the biggest factor.
And do you think there's a lack of trust now?
Well, I think there always has been. I think that that kind of suspicion has always, in some ways, been a good thing. It's one of the things that helped us to keep politics accountable. That, you know, we knew that people were handling billions of dollars worth of money at these various political levels, and we knew that there had to be a certain accountability to what those people were doing. But I think, you know, 100 years ago, the coffee shop talk around London or around any city would have been all about how politics sucks, right? How the people and the governments aren't doing what they were supposed to. I think that's always been there. But then people would go out and vote, or people would take part in campaigns, or people belong to political parties. Now the vast majority of Canadians don't belong to any party. And also, they don't get out and vote. In London, for instance, less than 50% voted in the last civic election. So, you know, it's that inability of being able to be turned off by the political system not being sensitive to us, but feeling that, okay, well, the way I'm going to deal with that is just by checking out, rather than checking in and voting and trying to make a difference in the next election. And I think that spelled all the difference. That allows politicians to feel that people aren't listening, so therefore they can continue to do as they wish.
I mean, there's active politicians out there that are trying to engage or disengage people from the process.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, as I tell people, I was on a trip to Europe for the G8, and I was with a minister from the Conservative government who was also a friend of mine. But as we were flying along in the airplane, he was telling me, Glenn, look, the difference between you and, say, as a Liberal or other people out there and people like ourselves as a party, he said, was that, you know, when you see negative advertising, you get turned off. You don't like to see that happening. But the point is, the more that we can turn off voters and mobilize our base, then the more we will continue to win. And those were his words exactly, and I blogged about it at the time. I didn't mention his name. But that is a strategy, and that, you know, that is voter suppression. That's done in both the United States and here, as well as within other countries. So it's not just that citizens are being turned off. It's the knowledge by some parties and some governments that the more that they can turn you off, the less you will vote for a change. And the more they can mobilize their base and get them out and continue to win elections. And that, I think, is a real problem. And because all the politicians know that the public is turning off of this stuff. The, you know, I was in question period for 5 years, and I would see people with the school groups and stuff in there. And, you know, they would try to cover the kids' ears. I literally saw that once as the politicians were swearing at one another during question period. So, you know, I think they know that the public is getting turned off by their actions, but to some people that's actually advantageous because that means that those people who want change will not go out and vote.
Okay, so that's the problem. Well, we're well aware that it's actually working rather well, and we can see that by, you know, a conservative majority in Ottawa, even though it's, you know, it's been well documented that they got there by fraud and robocalls and illicit tactics, but they're still there.
Right, and, you know, I mean, I was one of the ridings in which the robocalls was done, and it was a shock when I lost. Nobody expected me to. I didn't expect to. The media were all there for the victory party because they thought I would be there. But I think what I want to say is, in spite of the stuff that all, the fact that all those things have happened, you look at the conservative poll numbers now, or you look at the poll numbers for parties in general, they continue to slip. And part of that is because, you know, maybe the leaders aren't connecting or whatever it is. But a big part of it is, I think, that, you know, you can do that for a period of time, but eventually Canadians will catch on. And they're tired of watching it on the news. But where it really gets them is in the pocketbook. So we have not really recovered from this last recession. I mean, that's a well-known thing in Canada. Even though the recession officially ended 2 years ago, people still can't find work. You know, we still don't have an answer for climate change. We don't know what to do about research at universities. We know that healthcare is eventually going to explode. So seniors are having more and more trouble with security in the future, and I still direct the food bank in London. You know, our numbers are going up 10% every year, and we've been around for 26 years. So things are actually not getting better, even though the recession has ended. And when that happens, people feel offended that in spite of their difficulties, politicians are behaving like this in a public format. And what you end up seeing is that politics becomes not just more unpopular, but political parties themselves do. And I think that's what's happened to the Conservatives at the moment. And the Liberals are surging right now because of Justin Trudeau, and I know Justin well, and I understand all that. But all he has to do is turn around and start firing right back at Stephen Harper, and people will turn off of him as well. So I think we've been now been at it long enough, and people have been under duress for a fair period of time now, 5 or 6 years for many of them, that they're not prepared to accept this kind of theater of the absurd that they see, whether it's at Queen's Park or at City Council Chamber or in Ottawa, and they want to change.
Itemizes the problem. So how do we change it?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that, we need to do as citizens, you know, they can go ahead and join groups and all those kind of things, but if they're not going to vote, it doesn't matter. You know, I've done a lot of work with Romeo Dallaire, for instance. He and I have done a lot of overseas work together in Africa and other places. But Romeo was recently here at the Western University, and I had to introduce him, and he got up and talked about the various ages in society. You had the Iron Age and the Information Age and all that kind of stuff. But now he says we're in the technological age. And he said, for the first time in all of history, the one group that really knows how to marshal the forces of the technological age and use it are the youth. They're on it all the time. And yet the youth don't vote. So he was looking right at them, at the audience, and these are all university students, and saying, you know, you turn off, you want changes, you want things to develop more in favor of the next generation and all of those things that matter to the next generation. You know how to use technology, and yet rather than changing the world, because you are actually the best equipped to use this new technology in a new age, you just tune out. And he said, it doesn't matter how much you know, it doesn't matter how much you do. If in the end you're not going to vote, you're not going to get any changes. University costs are still going to continue to go up. You're still going to have trouble getting jobs and everything else because public policy is not being dealt with properly because people are checking out. So, you know, it still gets back to the old thing. Voting is still really, really important.
Well, without voting, I mean, what do we have, right?
Well, I think, you know, without voting, it's still true that, you know, although Canadians are disengaging more and more, they're also expressing their anger more and more. So I think, you know, even though federally, for instance, there's not a vote for another 2 years, you know, and I can speak best at that level, you know, they are aware that even though there's no vote about ready to take place, that they're losing support, you know, and the parties are realizing that their constituents are really peeved. And I think that, you know, even if people don't vote, their expression of their discontent does carry sway. But if in the end we end up having an election, and only 60% of the people vote, then all that worry was for nothing because the public actually didn't come out and deliver on the goods and didn't come through with all the things that they were complaining about. So still at the end of the day, the best thing that the individual citizen has is the vote. If they want to do all of these other things and get involved, that's terrific. But if you're not going to vote in the end, don't complain because things didn't change.
So what do you say to the people that, I mean, the stats are 29% are just not interested in voting?
Right, and, you know, I think if everything was fine, I'm not sure there's much we could do about that. But a lot of those 29%, of the people that make up that sector or that cohort are people that come to the food bank. You know, there are people that are jobless. They are people that really care about the environment, for instance, and nothing's happening about climate change. They're seniors who are losing their security and are worried about it. People who have trouble finding affordable housing. A lot of those people, it's absolutely true that they are, you know, wanting to check out and don't care, but their circumstances are directly affected by their lack of involvement. So I think that is beginning to change. You know, even at the food bank, we're beginning to see people asking more and more, what can I do to change this kind of thing? And voting will be part of it.
They say single parents, new immigrants, and skilled trade workers are among those that are the least likely to vote.
Yes, that's true. And, you know, in places like London, for instance, the waiting list for somebody on affordable housing is 8.3 years. That's how long it is. And if that single mother, for instance, with three kids, which is somebody that we're trying to help now at the food bank, just as an example, we were able to get her put on an emergency list to get affordable housing, and it was still 1.3 years. So she's hugely angry. Her husband had committed suicide because he lost his job in St. Thomas. And, you know, it was very difficult. And she's hugely angry at government and companies and others for letting it happen. So she's gone through that grief period, but she's now starting to say, what can I do to change it? You know, unless governments get involved and the governments start intervening and start passing better policy, people like that will just keep being frustrated. So I do think that the longer that this goes on, the more chance that we have of people who are right now turned off and angry will eventually realize that the vote is maybe the only way they can change it.
I run a youth group, as you know, in London. And I mean, one of our mandates is to get those youth civically involved. I mean, one of our facilitators, we just got elected onto the Youth Advisory Council. And we've got them involved in the political campaign in London West. And, you know, it's not all that difficult to get youth involved, in my experience, when you have the ability to talk one-on-one and inspire them.
Right.
What can we do to expand that?
I think a big part of the problem, to be honest, about youth is that they are really interested in issues. I do a lot of speaking on things like Africa, human rights. I've got 3 kids from Africa, for instance. So when we go out and speak about that, or we speak about the food bank and poverty, or we speak about Aboriginal situations, kids are naturally inclined towards issues, not so much towards policy. So if they know that somebody is really struggling in their community, there's really a real ability there within young people to gather together and want to make a difference there. And, you know, so with things like Occupy, for instance, there's so many young people involved in all of that. And so I think that, you know, it's good that they have that desire for issues. The problem with politics is it's not interested in issues. So the real things that are facing us as a country right now, for instance, the things I've already mentioned, like climate change and seniors and healthcare, all those kind of things, when is the last serious policy reform that's come out of Ottawa about those things? Nothing. It's been years, right? So although young people are really interested in things like slavery in Africa or things like Aboriginal poverty here in Canada, they can't find anything within the political construct that says, okay, give us your ideas and we'll change our policy to reflect the concerns that you have. What the political system does really well is that it looks at young people, and whenever it has a press conference, it always puts the young people behind the particular party leader. All parties do this. So that it looks like, you know, that they've really got the young people's vote with it. And then they leave town and they never even talk to the young people again. So there has to be an ability, I think, within riding associations and political riding associations to come to the level of youth groups, universities, things like the Occupy stuff, students that are involved in development work overseas or whatever it is, and coming and saying, you know, we're not asking you to come into the party and become a liberal or become a conservative or NDP or Green, whatever. We're asking you to come and give us your ideas and help us to change policy. If the political system would do that, I think the young people would feel that they're maybe being listened to. But they're not, and until politics changes that way, it's going to be hard for kids to feel they connect, in spite of all of the effort that you do and that others undertake to help young people. Still, at the political level, young people feel just marginalized.
Like you, I've worked on a lot of campaigns through the years, and every single time I'm working with politicians, and I'm like, we need to start driving issues-based campaigning, and there's always a reluctance to do that.
Always, and it's because it interrupts the status quo. And, you know, so we go on like this for decades, really. I mean, the middle class has been shrinking here for 2 decades. And we know that. The cost of university has been going up for 2 decades. We know that as well. The cost of healthcare is no longer affordable. So we all know that this stuff is coming. You look at the flooding in Alberta, the flooding in India right now, right? It's just terrible. We all know that climate change is coming. But it's kind of like we're just mesmerized by these huge problems, and we're afraid to take the risk to clear them up. Because if in order to change things, I might have to tax people a bit more to have the revenue to make the changes, or I might have to start cooperating with other parties to help seniors who have fallen onto difficult times and come up with policies that will really help. These parties will not work together. They won't deal with it. So I think, although the longer that people are in difficult times, the more that issues become important. I have 7 children, right? And some of them, are 2 of them are having trouble getting jobs and they're moving back home. Right. Well, I can tell you that story has been repeated thousands and thousands and thousands of times just in this region of southwestern Ontario. London has the highest unemployment rate in the country, even though we have a university. So these are issues, and these are issues that all of us have to face every day. And if we look at a political system that just uses these vague values that they throw us. So until, I think, we can hammer through to the politicians, we want you to deal with our issues right now, then the system will not change. And that's why citizens have to speak up, because I think that the politicians are too afraid to make a move.
And what about protests?
Well, I think, you know, protests are important, and I think what we're beginning to see is more and more of them. You look at Brazil, for instance, and what's going on right now. I mean, it's all of a sudden getting the government to look at more democratic measures of what it has to do, or we look at the Arab Spring or whatever. But often it will come out like something like Occupy. When the Occupy movement happened here in London, I became part of that. Even though I was older, I was the food bank director, and I felt that they were speaking to really, really important issues. But they would not move to within institutions and try to change them. All they wanted to do was criticize them. So if that's the way that we're going to do it, we're going to stand outside a city hall and say, you have to change this, 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 and this. The problem is in the city council chamber is really where we need their influence. So what I've been spending a lot of the last 2 years of doing is encouraging people that are 40 years old and younger to start running for city council. And we're starting to have some real success with that. But, you know, protest is really important because it's the canary in the coal mine. It reminds everybody that all is not well in Canadian society. But unless it can get within the institutional doors and begin pressing for the change from the inside, what's to come of it? Eventually you'll wait for the whole thing to come crashing down around our ears, and then we'll all want change. But none of us want it to go that far. We would like to be able to reform and refine and get those changes just at times like now, when the times are difficult, but we could maybe by cooperating together move our way out of it. But there's just not that kind of inclination right now within citizens, not just within politicians.
Yeah, and I can't see a Canadian lighting themselves on fire in front of Parliament to spark a movement.
No, I totally agree with you on that. On the other hand, you know, we did have the Winnipeg riots all those decades ago. I think we're getting closer and closer to those times. I mean, people cannot stay unemployed for as long as they are without something beginning to happen. And unemployment is key to all of this. But eventually, you're going to see people like in Alberta, environmentalists have been trying to say that this problem would be coming, that climate change is real. But, you know, policymakers continue to ignore those kind of warnings. Well, at some point, that is not, I don't think a Canadian is probably going to set themselves on fire, but you're going to get thousands and thousands of people marching on Queen's Park or at City Hall or in Ottawa, and then they'll start happening every week with different groups starting to do it, and then all of a sudden the politicians feel like, you know, the pressure is really on. We have to change. We have to do something. And the big thing then is to make sure that they don't make cosmetic changes, but that they make real change.
Anything else you want to tell people, Glenn?
You know, I'll be honest with you that when the federal election was over for me in 2011, I just decided after 5 years of being in Parliament, and I was known in Parliament as a guy that would fight for the little guy, the small advocacy group, the students or whatever. So I'm not trying to make myself out to be anything special, but I just felt that was important, and that's why I got elected. And so although I try to help all those groups to get access, I realized that really they didn't have a lot of authority behind them because Canadians didn't care. So if it was students that were wanting their rates lowered or somebody that wanted immigration change or environmental change, those people all knew that in spite of the fact they might have 1,000 people in their organization, they could not mobilize citizens to change. And as a result of that, the politicians would sit there and wait for them and listen to them, but knew it wouldn't make any difference when it came to a vote. And I think, to be honest with you, up until probably 4 or 5 months ago, I was really discouraged that I had taken that step in my life to get out of politics and to just work with citizens. And really discouraged because people just didn't seem to care. They were checking out. But I have noticed just in these last few months, especially as economic times don't change, there has been a bit of a movement. And I do believe if the Senate crisis would have happened, for instance, 2 years ago, or all the stuff of that's been going on in Ottawa or Queen's Park these days would have happened 2 or 3 years ago, nothing would have changed. But I think now what's beginning to happen is Canadians are starting to get angrier, and there is a chance that that could change more and more of the system. But it won't make any difference at the end of the day if the students don't vote. And that's the one thing I can't guarantee. You know, I give all my time to it. I try to work on it, not because I'm a great guy. It's just I worry about my community and about democracy. But if people at the end of the day go, Glenn, that was great. How can we help the food bank? Or, you know, what can we do to help you with these other causes? And then they don't go out and vote. We'll always just be deteriorating all the time. So I don't want to be discouraged any longer. And I think I'm getting a little bit more positive by what I see. But this is our establishment. This is our place. The secret of democracy is not found in the politician or the prime minister. It's always found in the citizen, who's the one person who has the right to choose who he wants or she wants to govern them. And if we refuse to do that, it's over. right? So at some point, the only way we can change it is not by rebelling or protesting. All those things are good, and I think they should be done, even civil disobedience. But at some point, unless you're going to vote, you're not going to change anything. So I'm hoping people will arrive at that point. It's a far more of a peaceful way of changing our society than just protesting and doing nothing else.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been a pleasure. And for everyone else out there, you can listen to all of our other shows and all of our blogs and other things at www.betweenthemargins.ca. And we hope that you have a happily ever after, whatever that means to you.